Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Susan Shand. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Foreign ministers from countries belonging to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization are gathering in Washington to mark the 70th anniversary of the military alliance. NATO is one of the oldest common defense alliances of its kind and one of the most successful. The group includes Britain, France, and Germany, but also has added countries such as Turkey and Greece that are not near the Atlantic Ocean. NATO was formed to be an alliance of Western nations that would balance the military power of the Soviet Union and its allies in Eastern Europe. After the former Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, some experts questioned what part the alliance would play in international security. Since that time, NATO members have taken part in conflicts in Kosovo, Iraq, and Afghanistan. NATO also has expanded to include countries that were once part of the Soviet bloc: Croatia, the Czech Republic, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, Hungary, Poland, and Romania were formerly allied to the Soviet Union. U.S. President Donald Trump has criticized the group both as a presidential candidate and after taking office in 2017. Trump has said that many NATO members do not spend enough on defense to meet their commitments fully under the agreement. He suggested that NATO may no longer be useful. He once called it obsolete. Trump's criticism of the alliance has concerned European allies. However, some U.S. officials have also been frustrated over European positions on some security issues affecting NATO. For example, Germany has planned an undersea gas pipeline with Russia. In addition, the U.S. is worried about Europeans' apparent lack of concern over security threats presented by China. And some European members have sharply disagreed with the U.S. on expanding restrictions on Iran for its nuclear program and activities in the Middle East. They also have criticized the U.S. for withdrawing from a nuclear agreement with Russia, which the U.S. says Russia has not observed. However, most foreign policy experts say NATO is a success. Mark Simakovsky is with the Atlantic Council, a research group in Washington. He told VOA that NATO has showcased an ability to adapt to change in the past, and it is dealing with issues like cyber warfare and spending more on defense. Trump is not the first U.S. leader to call for NATO members to do more to defend their countries. President Barack Obama also pressed allies to spend more on defense. Other presidents have done so as well. In 2014, NATO members agreed on spending what is equal to 2% of their economies on their militaries each year. Most have never reached that level. NATO's 2018 report says 7 of its 29 member states reached the 2% spending promise. Kurt Volker is director of the McCain Institute in Washington. He also served as the U.S. ambassador to NATO. Volker said defense spending shows a country's commitment to its own security. He said such spending gives other NATO members confidence that the group can help defend that country. Hans Kundnani is with the British research group Chatham House. He said Europe needs to do more to share the burden of common defense. In 2018, Britain supplied the most among European countries to the defense costs of the alliance. Recently, a group of 8 former British military and intelligence chiefs warned that Britain could drop from being a top military power unless it does more for its defense. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Washington, D.C.'s cherry blossom trees are in full bloom. The United States National Park Service declared that the blossoms reached peak bloom on Monday. That means 70% of the Yoshino cherry trees around the city's tidal basin are flowering. Depending on weather conditions, peak bloom can last between just a few days or 7 to 10 days. After what seemed like a long winter, mild weather returned to the D.C. area last weekend. On Saturday, the official daytime temperature reached 79 degrees Fahrenheit, or 26 degrees Celsius. Many Washingtonians spent the day outdoors. They and thousands of out-of-town visitors walked among the cherry trees. For a time, Washington did not feel like a busy capital city. The famous lack of political harmony was nowhere to be found. People smiled, laughed, and pointed up at the tiny blossoms. Many lifted cell phones high in the air and took pictures. Families spread blankets on the grass and enjoyed picnics. Under a sunny sky, boaters drifted along the Potomac River. One could hear people speaking in different languages, including Japanese, Chinese, German, and Spanish. Jack Elmira and his twin 10-year-old sons, Toby and Joe, walked among the trees looking up into the blossoms. They had planned to visit Washington for more than a year and were pleased that they had timed their trip correctly. "I was here once before," Jack Elmira said, "but the trees still had frost on them. That was years ago. I'm just happy my sons get to see them at their best." D.C.'s first cherry trees were a gift from Tokyo Mayor Yukio Ozaki back in 1912. Today, the Cherry Blossom Festival takes place every year. It celebrates the close cultural ties between the United States and Japan. The Park Service said it expects more than 1.5 million people to walk among the more than 3,000 white and pink trees over the next few days. Some people also walked across the National Mall to the World War II Memorial. It was built in 2004 to honor the 16 million Americans who fought in the war. Its fountains throw off cool drops of water with the Washington Monument in the background. Visitors can place their feet in the water or take pictures at its edge. Lucy Manor of Arlington, Virginia, carefully walked along the edge. "These are the days when Washington feels like a dream city," she said. The National Cherry Blossom Festival continues until Saturday, April 13th, and ends with the festival's parade. The parade march stretches along Constitution Avenue and is open to the public. I'm Susan Shand.
A new report says the shortage of skilled teachers in the United States is a bigger problem than people may think. The not-for-profit Washington-based Economic Policy Institute, or EPI, published the report last week. It was the first in a six-part series that aims to examine the causes of and solutions for the national teacher shortage in U.S. public schools. Education experts have long been concerned about rising teacher shortages. The issue has grown more severe in recent years. EPI's report notes that less than 10 years ago, many teachers were looking for jobs. Then, in 2012, public schools were looking for teachers. That year, the country faced a shortage of 20,000 school teachers. By the 2017 to 2018 school year, the country was estimated to have a shortage of over 110,000 teachers. Those numbers come from the Learning Policy Institute. However, EPI researchers Emma Garcia and Elaine Weiss argue that such estimates are still far too low. They say the estimates do not consider that many current teachers lack necessary training, experience, and official approval to teach. Garcia and Weiss found that nationwide, one-third of teachers do not have an education background in the main subject that they teach. And more than 20% have less than 5 years of teaching experience. About 9% are teaching without the usual state certification. The study found those numbers to be even greater in high-poverty schools, where more than half of students receive free or reduced-cost meals. In such schools, almost 40% of teachers do not have previous education in the main subjects they teach, and about one-quarter have little classroom experience. More and more, qualified educators are either quitting or deciding not to enter the teaching field at all, the EPI report says. Many leave the field because of poor working conditions. They also object to low pay. The average yearly pay for public school teachers has fallen in recent years, even as the cost of living and other expenses continue to rise. In a statement, Garcia said the shortages of skilled teachers threaten students' ability to learn and reduce teachers' effectiveness. And she noted the high number of teachers who leave their jobs takes economic resources that could be better used somewhere else. A recent study by Gallup found that finding and keeping skilled teachers is the number one concern among public school officials. 61% of the superintendents questioned strongly agreed that recruiting and retaining good teachers would be a big problem for the schools they oversee in the coming year.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell the story of that war.
Unlike other presidents of the late 1800s, William McKinley spent much of his presidency dealing with foreign policy. The most serious problem involved Spain. Spain ruled Cuba at that time. Cuban rebels had started a fight for independence. The Spanish government promised the Cuban people equal rights and self-rule, but in the future. The rebels did not want to wait. President McKinley felt Spain should be left alone to honor its promises. He also felt responsible for protecting the lives and property of Americans in Cuba. When riots broke out in Havana, he ordered the battleship Maine to sail there. One night in early 1898, a powerful explosion sank the Maine. More than 250 American sailors died. There was some evidence the explosion was caused by an accident in the ship's fuel tanks, but many Americans blamed Spain. They demanded war to free Cuba and make it independent.
President McKinley had a difficult decision to make. He did not want war. As he told a friend, "I fought in our civil war. I saw the dead piled up. I do not want to see that again." But McKinley also knew many Americans wanted war. If he refused to fight Spain, his Republican Party could lose popular support. So, he did not ask Congress for a declaration of war right away. He sent a message to the Spanish government instead. McKinley demanded an immediate ceasefire in Cuba. He also offered his help in ending the revolt. By the time Spain agreed to the demands, McKinley had made his decision. He asked Congress for permission to use military force to bring peace to Cuba. Congress agreed. It also demanded that Spain withdraw from Cuba and give up all claims to the island. The president signed the congressional resolution. The Spanish government immediately broke relations. On April 25th, 1898, the United States declared war on Spain.
The American Navy was ready to fight. It was three times bigger than the Spanish Navy. It also was better trained. A shipbuilding program begun 15 years earlier had made the American Navy one of the strongest in the world. Its ships were made of steel and carried powerful guns. Part of the American Navy at that time was based in Hong Kong. The rest was based on the Atlantic coast of the United States. Admiral George Dewey commanded the Pacific Fleet. Dewey had received a message from the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Theodore Roosevelt. If war broke out, it said, he was to attack the Spanish naval force in the Philippines. The Spanish force was commanded by Admiral Patricio Montojo.
The American fleet arrived in Manila Bay on May 1st. It sailed toward the line of Spanish ships. The Spanish fired first. The shells missed. When the two naval forces were 5,000 meters apart, Admiral Dewey ordered the Americans to fire. After 3 hours, Admiral Montojo surrendered. Most of his ships were sunk. 400 of his men were dead or wounded. American land forces arrived several weeks later. They captured Manila, giving the United States control of the Philippines.
Dewey was suddenly a hero. Songs and poems were written about him. Congress gave him special honors. A spirit of victory spread across the nation. People called for an immediate invasion of Cuba. Unlike the Navy, America's army was not ready to fight. When war was declared, the army had only about 25,000 men. Within a few months, however, it had more than 200,000. The soldiers trained at camps in the southern United States. One of the largest camps was in Florida. Cuba is just 150 kilometers off the coast of Florida.
2 weeks after the Spanish-American War began, the Army sent a small force to Cuba. The force was ordered to inspect the north coast of Cuba and to take supplies to Cuban rebels. That invasion failed, but the second one succeeded. 400 American soldiers landed with guns, bullets, and supplies for the rebels. Next, the army planned to send 25,000 men to Cuba. Their goal was the port of Santiago on the south coast. American ships had trapped a Spanish naval force there earlier. One of the commanders of the big American invasion force was Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt had resigned as Assistant Secretary of the Navy when the war started. He organized a group of horse soldiers. Most of the men were cowboys from America's Southwest. They could ride and shoot well. Some were rich young men from New York who simply shared Roosevelt's love of excitement. The group became known as Roosevelt's Rough Riders.
As the Americans landed near Santiago, Spanish forces withdrew to positions outside the city. The strongest force was at San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers used smokeless gunpowder. This made their artillery hard to find. The Americans did not have the smokeless powder, but they had Gatling machine guns, which poured a stream of bullets at the enemy. When the machine guns opened fire, American soldiers began moving up San Juan Hill. Several American reporters watched. Later, one of them wrote this report. I have seen many pictures of the charge on San Juan Hill, but none seem to show it as I remember it. In the pictures, the men are running up the hill quickly in straight lines. There seem to be so many men that no enemy could stand against them. In fact, said the reporter, there were not many men, and they moved up the hill slowly, in a close group, not in a straight line. It seemed as if someone had made a terrible mistake. One wanted to call to these few soldiers to come back.
The American soldiers were not called back. They reached the top of San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers fled. All we have to do, an American officer said, is hold on to the hill, and Santiago will be ours. American Commander General William Shafter sent a message to Spanish Commander General José Toral. Shafter demanded Toral's surrender. While he waited for an answer, the Spanish naval force tried to break out of Santiago Harbor. The attempt failed, and the Americans took control of the port. The loss destroyed any hope that Spain could win the war. There was now no way it could send more soldiers and supplies to Cuba. General Toral agreed to a short ceasefire so women and children could leave Santiago. But he rejected General Shafter's demand of unconditional surrender. American artillery then attacked Santiago. General Toral defended the city as best he could. Finally, on July 17th, he surrendered. The United States promised to send all his soldiers back to Spain.
In the next few weeks, American forces occupied Puerto Rico and the Philippine capital of Manila. America's war with Spain was over. It had lasted just 10 weeks. The next step was to negotiate terms of a peace treaty. The negotiations would be held in Paris. The victorious United States demanded independence for Cuba. It demanded control over Puerto Rico and Guam, and it demanded the right to occupy Manila. The two sides agreed quickly on the terms concerning Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Guam, but they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. Spain rejected the American demand for control. It did not want to give up this important colony. Negotiations on this point of the peace treaty lasted for days.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.